Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. This is episode number 52, and you knew it was inevitable that at some point during the first year of doing an RSP Cast, and I tried to like stretch it out as long as possible because I knew like when I even started a podcast that I would have this gentleman on this podcast numerous times, but I wanted to play a little game with my audience and make them beg for it a little bit more, which was to have my buddy, football guys, Sigmund Bloom on the show. And I've been looking forward to this as much as you guys have. Sig?
Yeah.
Welcome to my room.
Oh, it's great. It's really, it's a lot like my room. The couch is familiar. Did I give this couch to you or did you give Mike that couch to me? We're finding the same things in the cushions. It's great. Football has become this monster, too big to fail thing. And because we were fascinated by it and liked expressing ourselves about it and other people out there were willing to consume what we do, here we are. It's been quite a journey. And I'm glad now that it includes the RSP Cast. And I'm glad that it's draft season. I'm glad that, Matt, I think that going back to when you and I first met and talked, so many more people are speaking the language of football that was there and that we were just trying to strain and hear that beat over all the din. And now there's so many people that are listening for that. And it's a beautiful thing to be part of this community.
It really is. And I think that sometimes people forget that, you know, they can get on social media and they aren't able to look beyond the veneer of what social media can be in a bad way. And they forget that really lost in all of that is people who are trying to find that signal through the noise, you know, mm-hmm. and even if the signal, even if what you think their signal is noisy, the fact that they're searching is really a cool thing. And today I thought it would just be fun for us to talk about the 2019 NFL draft. And when I proposed, you know, to Bloom to get on this show, you know, I was like, how about we just talk about some draft narratives that are going on and then we can just kind of bounce it back and forth about players, teams, whatever comes to mind. So, you know, what comes to mind to you when you think about this draft?
Well, of course, if you give me a directive, an open-ended directive, I'm in like a balloon, like a kid that lets go of a balloon in the parking lot. That's my brain. draft and narrative, because certainly, if we just kept it really simple and said, what are some of the narratives about this year's draft? Kyler Murray, baseball, football, and his height, and so many of them, right? I mean, that's kind of what's beautiful about this. This is where we go back to college. This is the Lyceum. Every player in the draft is inherently a case in a long case study on any number of things that you're looking at. The hypotheses you're testing about correlations between NFL success and what we know at the time of the draft about a player. Every player is an intersection of six or eight different things we could say about, you know, production and pedigree and traits and skills and athleticism. They're their own case and their own story that plays out that there go our story that adds to the chronicle of, you know, short quarterbacks or players that tried to juggle two sports. And you can apply this to every player in the draft. And then it becomes larger. And those are on roads to larger conversations about football theory and football study and things like that. So absolutely, it'd be engrossing just to talk about the narratives about this year's draft. But when you sent me draft narrative, I mean, first thing I just started thinking about was the types of narratives that we, the public consuming the draft, create about in general. I thought about players. I mean, we have narratives about their coaches. We have narratives about their health. We have narratives about character, things that happen to them in their life and how it's going to affect them as a football player. And then we have narratives about teams and what teams have done and the way teams think and what they're likely to do and not likely to do. And then we have narratives about the draft itself. You know, it's a crapshoot.
I think one of the things that you touched upon when you talk about narratives with players and that comes up to mind right away for me is who gets invited to the combine and who doesn't.
Here we are today.
Combine. You know, I mean, I think it was Simmons, Justin Simmons and Preston Williams. And you know, I don't know the complete history of Preston Williams, but I've read at least why he got suspended. And it, you know, to for it to be even compared, you know, it can be compared broadly to, say, Joe Mixon or Tyreek Hill. But from what I read, if I heard this right, was that he shoved his girlfriend. They got into an altercation where he shoved her and he tried to hold her from going out the door, and it was a misdemeanor and he pled out, and that was it. But then what I also heard was, you know, about 200 phone calls. He tried to call her about 200 different times and leave messages, which also sounds very high school, college kind of thing as well, in a dysfunctional way. But, you know, I look at that, and unless I'm missing something more, and I might be, you know, I look at that and I say, you know, it certainly could have been a serious issue, could have been a more serious thing. But it doesn't necessarily equate to me to, you know, strangling your pregnant girlfriend or kicking her or doing something along the lines of what some of these other players have done. So you kind of, you know, it's interesting to me, because then I see things where the narrative gets perpetuated to, like, yeah, this guy has a long history of issues. And then I look, and from what I've read, it doesn't sound like that. Maybe I'm wrong. Did I miss something with him? Do you know?
I mean, you know, I haven't really dug in, but I think that, Matt, we could probably flip a whole show starting to talk about things that we think about whenever we talk about the NFL and its approach to domestic violence, its approach to character incidents in a player's past. And I mean, what this stands for in my mind is basically that the NFL feels like they have to do something. So we did this. Well, we did disinvite these players to the combine. We don't keep them from playing, which is a whole other debate, and right. Actually would indicate some sincere attempt to ameliorate the problem. But these things are a morass right now, these conversations around football. I don't think it's going to affect their stock at all.
Yeah, I don't either. And I think that's the thing that people don't get a clue of, is because you look at Joe Mixon, you look at Tyreek Hill, and it didn't, you know.
Not in the least bit. Point.
Not very much at best. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, then who are some players who didn't get, you know, I mean, who are some players that you are interested in specifically in terms of the scope of, you know, you mentioned Kyler Murray, but yeah. you can talk about him or anybody else that you feel like their arc is changing due to external factors.
Yeah. And of course, when we say arc changing external factors, it's also like sometimes we do kind of in real time learn as the league learns. And then sometimes we become aware later on of something that was always believed behind closed doors in the league, you know, or known. But there's a lot of fascinating players. I think, and I'm still very early in my preparation. I'm going to put together the first Bloom 100 next week, hopefully by the end of the week, and really just immerse myself and swim around in the ocean of this class. But I think that already, and if this is where Draft Twitter is actually outstanding. I mean, Draft Twitter really functions as a hive mind. And if you follow the right people, I have a Draft Knicks list that has 128 on it. I'm sure I'm going to add more this year. Every year there's more new bright minds joining us in the Draft Twitter world. And it gives you an idea of the actual conversations or thoughts or takes, however you want to call it, that are happening about a player. So already I think Josh Allen from Kentucky becomes really interesting, because you already have some people who are valid and sound voices out there saying, like, I don't see top three. You know, I don't see him in the category of Quinnen Williams and Nick Bosa. And then there are some, I see, like, reducing him more to his components and saying, well, this production component and this athleticism component, level of competition component, it all makes sense. So that's going to be interesting to watch play out. And of course, what's great here, let me step back and say this. What's really fun about playing the narrative game with the draft, and I'm the mayor of Narrative Street, I've been told, is that you get some sort of confirmation. You get a reveal. And we're, you know, and I know, Matt, you don't like necessarily to play this speculation game of when is a player going to go or who's going to take them, although it's a game you'll dabble in. But that's the game that when it comes right down to it on draft morning, draft afternoon, draft evening, we're obsessed with. It's like plate tectonics of the NFL, the draft. It gives us precursors to things later on that we don't know they're coming, but we'll look back.
Yeah, and remember. It's a market report.
You know? Yeah. And it also sets alternate universes in motion, and it erases alternate universes that will never happen, but could have been something very different than what we know.
Yeah, true enough. You know, and I mean, it's funny because Jackson Block, who writes for the RSP, who's a former edge rusher in his day playing in high school and a little bit of college before he got injured. He's one of those guys who's on the high side of Allen. You know, he definitely sees the guy needs to refine his skills, but looks at him as the clear number two to Nick Bosa, on this particular front. So it's, I can definitely see where that's part of it. I mean, what do you think of this quarterback class?
Yeah, right.
You're hearing.
So this is fun because when we're evaluating quarterbacks for the draft, we're kind of all on our own to go wherever we want it to take us. But when it comes down to predicting where they'll go and when they'll go in the draft, that's also a gauge of the quarterback thirst in the NFL or the quarterback thirst among the specific teams that are needing a quarterback, or maybe a team or two lurking that we don't see coming, that are less satisfied. And of course, we'll have another piece of this story before the draft when we find out what happens with Teddy Bridgewater, Ryan Tannehill, Nick Foles, Joe Flacco, and so on. And usually the teams end up with those players, often still draft a quarterback, if not the year they make a move like that, but maybe the year after, so that doesn't solve their quarterback problem. But it gives us a sense maybe of what they value, what they're looking for in a quarterback, what they can stomach at quarterback even. And I think that's what they can stomach is basically like what's going to drive this class, this top four. Drew Locke, more like traits, Kyler Murray, I think I talked about the questions that he brings up. Haskins, who, I haven't seen anybody stand on the table for him yet. Right. I haven't seen anybody say that, this is somebody that a team needs to trade up for, or even the Giants need to put it in ink, and Jones from Duke. So,
I can tell you this. I think that this is the year, and I have not studied Haskins or Murray yet.
Okay.
So to be fair, I could be way, I have a feeling I may be way off with this, but from what I've seen of Haskins and what I've seen of Murray, and then what I've studied of Daniel Jones, this is the year where we're going to get to see desperation with some teams where they're going to go, and how good their decision making is. Because, I was on with Patricia Train, yesterday for Big Blue, for the Giants podcast. And we talked about, what they should do about Eli Manning. And my thought was, you got to keep him, because if you drafted Saquon Barkley, I'm not going to look at that as a mistake, but it will be a mistake if you decide to get desperate and draft a quarterback this year, instead of just build up the infrastructure around Saquon Barkley and around this offense, so you can give Eli a fighting chance and just know that you need to have a really great team around him, so that either when you get rid of him or if he plays well enough, then you'll have some success when you get rid of him, either for a better draft pick next year or the year after, or for a free agent who becomes available, who's capable of being able to deliver even better, more than what you got from Eli Manning. And I think, to me, what happens with these teams is that they didn't look as far ahead as they should have. Maybe they don't bother to look ahead because the lead decision maker is like, what, me look at the next year's draft class, me consider what was written down for me in a report to read and study, from my scouting group or from my GM, me doing that? No. I'm just going to watch ESPN and kind of drive down the decisions that I think based on what I heard Colin Cowherd say. So it's one of those deals where I look at this and I think, this is the year that you're going to see whether your team has a long-term vision or has a vision that's going to really build a solid team, or whether they're just winging it year to year,
right,
and they're being driven by their from the top down, by an uninformed top down. Because I look at Daniel Jones and I just don't get it.
Right. Well, and that's so this is great. I mean, the draft and narrative and talking to you, Matt Waldman, every year we get a test of, are teams going to avoid the trap? Are they going to be like Matt Waldman and say no in the first round to a quarterback who gives you hesitation? And most years they don't. Every now and then teams that get rewarded, like Oakland, at least for a bit with Derek Carr, you know, Colin Kaepernick, San Francisco. I mean, they're quarterbacks outside of the first round. But let's just say that in the top 3, 4, 5, the decision to take a quarterback, if we're talking about that quarterback, then they should be a pretty exceptional prospect. Jared Goff and Carson Wentz are interesting because they're both at this moment successes, but at the time they were cited as, oh, the two desperate. These guys at 1 and 2, ooh, you know, this reeks of desperation. Maybe they can be Mitchell Trubisky number 3, sparked a similar conversation, and we'll see. You know, I mean, in some ways, the verge is still out always on players this early in their career. But you look at this class, Matt, and these guys, again, at first glance, are underwhelming in a way that the EJ Manuel class was.
Yes.
And on that draft weekend, the Buffalo Bills took the bait. Okay, you know, but they still didn't get stung. And when you look at that first round class, it's one of the worst ever. So you can't really ding them too hard for Manuel when you look at the career trajectories of other players in that round. And everybody else said, remember they were talking about like Nassib top 10, Barkley top 10?
Yes.
And not only were they not top 10, and this is something people were at least entertaining the possibility of that day, like when the draft began, Barkley in the top 10, now Nassib to, you know, Hackett and that whole thing. And instead, they actually didn't take the bait. And those guys fell to the third day.
Yeah.
And it was, we were going to applaud them and say, they got it. They got the memo, Matt. You know, take a good player. Don't get obsessed with quarterback. So this draft and how this draft turns out will be a very interesting data point. And it's about these, like you said, these specific decision makers. Because if it was a different 5 teams, maybe we'd have a whole different result. But starting at the top with the Giants, Dave Gettleman actually does not strike me as someone that would take the bait. He strikes me as someone that would be more along the Matt Waldman line of thinking.
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that that's the case too. Because
he had the biggest opportunity with Darnold. And Barkley, now the thing is, the denominator this year at number 6 isn't going to be a player like Barkley. So does that change the math for Gettleman?
Yeah, that's true. And to me, I mean, it's funny because one of the things that I thought with them is maybe one of the things that they should do is admit that Evan Ingram is a wide receiver, not a tight end, right, and actually use him as such, move Sterling Shepard permanently into the slot, or give him a chance to compete with Corey Coleman if Corey Coleman revives his career a little bit and actually is serious. And then you draft a tight end. You get one of these really good tight ends. Yeah, TJ Hockenson, exactly.
Right. It makes sense, right? So here's a narrative. Here's a narrative as we speak. I know there are people out there that love, I think, Thor from Roto World loves Thor, Hawkinson. Yeah. And I know Benjamin Solak, who is doing great work. The whole Draft Network team is great. It reminds me of Draft Mecca when there's a group of people that are energized about the draft and energizing each other and energizing us. And it's great. It's a great presence
out
there. Hawkinson is a top 10 pick. And I love that. I thought OJ Howard should have been a top 10 pick, and Hawkinson's a better prospect than Howard. And doesn't it fit, Matt, that at this moment, right? So what's the thing on defense? Oh, you want linebackers who can run and cover and hit and fill. Like, we need versatile linebackers, right? Super Bowl, et cetera, et cetera. But the counterpart on the offensive side can be a tight end, and Hawkinson fits that. Like, you want a tight end who can Rob Gronkowski. I mean, he's not a similar necessarily type of player as a receiver, but tactically what you can do with him, it's endless.
Well, you know, he studied, you know, I know someone who's related to that program who said that they gave him Gronkowski tape to study over the season, and that he'd picked up quite a few things in terms of how he attacks the football, how he gets into position as a route runner, and that's shown up. But, I mean, as a blocker, I mean, to me, he reminds me of Rob Gronkowski's running mate at the time that they were in the draft, same draft class, and that's Dennis Pitta. I think is a more athletic Dennis Pitta, a guy who can do it all for you. And he is, he's the highest graded tight end that I've, or that I've given the highest grade to this tight end than probably any tight end I've graded in a number of years, you know, and Irv Smith isn't far behind.
No, Noah Fant. Noah Fant.
I'm a little less on Noah Fant, but I understand the appeal for sure. You know, well, but then you've got Jay Sternberger.
Right. Who, it goes on and on.
Yeah. So you've got a number of guys here. And on top of that, it's like you see the thing. It's a safe pick, if you ask me, even though it's a, you know, it's weird. It's a weird pick because it's tight end is safe in the fact that you can get special teams play out of these guys. And then also what they usually can develop into and help out as far as pass protection is running, you know, run plays as well as the passing game. If you get the right ones. And I think that this is the class where we may look at 3 to 6 players and go, wow, this was actually a safe pick. Even though it's a difficult position to develop because that blocking element is usually much harder to go through. You know, in terms of say running backs this year, I mean, I look at this class, Bloom, and I know a lot of people are like, it's not the same as it was last year. And I'm thinking it will never be the same as it was last year, even if it didn't show up on the field initially. I think last year's was the most talented class I've seen. And I think the year before was pretty darn good. I think this class is closer to the 2017 class as opposed to the 2018 class, maybe a little bit less, but there's some guys in here who I think the narrative is that this class is actually being a little bit overlooked. And there are some guys in here who are really fascinating. And it kind of reminds me of like the year that we had Eddie Lacy and Jonathan Franklin kind of with Lattimore at the top. And there was this guy, Le'Veon Bell, who was pretty darn good, kind of lingering in there that people were like, I'm not really sure about him. And I think that there's like 3 or 4 guys that people are not really sure about, in addition to guys that no one's really even heard that much about or have overlooked, who could wind up being strong, you know, strong starters in this league if the opportunity arises.
It's a better than average class for sure. And maybe it's because the last two classes were so good that it might seem underwhelming. But I think in NFL terms, look at Sony Michel. I mean, let's be fair. So the Sony Michel NFL application of Sony Michel was not, as he translated to the NFL at this point, at least, you know, he wasn't necessarily providing like, he wasn't doing something unlocking
value. Carry on Johnson things.
Yeah. He wasn't unlocking value in the Patriots offense that would not have been there if they just had a merely competent runner. Yeah. You know, he was adding some like, you know, his vision and patience and things like that, more hidden things in his game, less flashy things, games that he brings helped enhance the value of their running game. But, you know, 50 running backs could have probably unlocked enough value from what he did for the Patriots to allow them to have the same trajectory as a team. You know, and the real narrative here is, of course, how important is running back, right? So in the background of any conversation about any running back now is this idea, Todd Gurley. Right. I mean, maybe we'll find out later on that Gurley, there is an explanation for what happened with Gurley.
He was hurt. I don't doubt that.
Sure. Yeah. Either way, the Rams as an offense without Gurley, at least until the Super Bowl, didn't really miss him. And CJ Anderson showed there's plenty of value for someone like CJ Anderson to unlock in that offense. The point being that the value the running back position creates to a W is really more remote than almost any other player on offense. At least it seems like teams are, I think, and this is where the Barkley conversation comes back to, you know, Gettleman and the Giants and number 6 and Haskins is running back. Are we seeing evidence that running back does not really influence the game? You know, not in a material way compared to other players. Regardless, from a, you know, meanwhile, there's like what we do to pay the bills fantasy. All of these guys could easily end up being for fantasy worth as much as the 2018 guys or the 2017 guys. And they not just because of their ability, which you're alluding to, but because the NFL will, there is actual rational coaching on most teams and young legs and players that add that energy. I mean, look what Marlon Mack is doing. He wasn't an outstanding prospect. He had strengths and those strengths are translating for the Colts, but it wasn't like we underestimated Marlon Mack and he's ended up being a way better pro than anybody could have projected. It's just that, well, the Colts are using him because he's the guy, next guy up, and he's producing. Damian Williams, look what the Chiefs are doing, you know? So yes, this group could yield a lot of fascinating team player combinations, a lot of veterans. Every year, it's like the culling of the veterans, like who's going to take a big step back now and kind of end up where Latavius Murray is in running back purgatory after 2-3 years ago being a coveted starter. And these guys are going to push a lot of those vets to the bench.
Yeah, I mean, I think running back doesn't matter as much as it once did because of the fact that it is a higher scoring game. It's easier to pass now than what it was in the in previous years. But I do think that you get guys like Gurley and Barkley, and they're guys that actually do make a difference for their teams, but it's more subtle than what your stats are going to show, unless you're going to now be able to start tracking player tendencies and movement tendencies, as well as understand how the blocking schemes work in a manner where that's helpful. Well, but I think to add to the argument with CJ Anderson, because you brought that up and said, you know, well, what about CJ Anderson? He was cut by two teams. Well, I say, here's the thing. I think the thing that we miss is that the running back position isn't lacking talent. I think if anything, there is a glut of talent at the running back position, and that just because John Elway may not have liked CJ Anderson, and it may not have had to do with anything on the field, because when CJ Anderson was in shape and played at the level that he was in Denver, that he emerged, you could argue that this would look like a Pro Bowl back who was on the verge of, you know, having that type of career, because he could do everything on the field. And then he just kept getting passed over. He wasn't favored because Elway decided to pick, you know, a guy like Devontae Booker, who is not one of those talented backs, but then tried to ramrod him into that system. And you can see that, you know, you're starting to see the criticism that Elway's gotten as a GM in terms of picking players. And you can see that, you know, there's a level of situations where teams, you know, or certain decision makers look and say, I don't like that player. It's not because he's not talented. It's because I prefer something different, or I want my guy, and I'm going to bet on my guy. And as a result, you know, you end up with these situations where a guy like Anderson is floating around.
Yeah. Well, and look, Anderson is better than we realize, or better than his reputation. You know, CJ Anderson isn't truly a street free agent, you know, but regardless, that reply applies to the 50th best running back in the league is better than we think. The 75th best running back in the league is better than we think. The 100th best running back is better than we think. And another good group is about to enter. There's more quality running backs out there than work for them, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
And it's going to continue to be like that. And if anything, this is going to push it even more into the glut of running backs. That's why it becomes interesting to see which teams decide to invest at the position and when in the draft, because it's an assessment of what they have. It's a possibly, like wasn't for Seattle last year, a statement about what's important to them in their conception of how they win games, or what kind of strength they want to try to maximize with the picks, like that it's going to converge, going to meet up the road. You know, we're going to take this first round pick because we're going to build a running game that these two can jive. And then, of course, what they think about the running backs they have on their roster right now. That's the sort of, like gossip, you know. And we also have seen that even though teams aren't willing to pay up in free agency, it's going to be gory again, right? Like poor Le'Veon Bell, he's going to be the punch. His contract's going to be like a punchline.
Right.
And so on down the line. Tevin Coleman, you know, he might not be signed to start. Although Jerry McKinnon in Minnesota San Fran last year said it only takes one team. But regardless, we saw what Matt Breida can be just as good. It's certainly teams are willing to invest in the draft. Maybe not in I mean, Barkley though, and Fournette, and it isn't just the, you know, Christian McCaffrey, who's been great, but still he went for a top 10 pick. So recently teams are still willing to invest high first round picks in running backs. And we're seeing a lot, and it's a testament to the classes too, but we're seeing a lot of second day picks at running back too. And they're good players at other positions on the second day, like players that if you're in a war room for an NFL team, it hurts to pass on. If you're really convinced that running back's an interchangeable position, it's hard to take a running back in the second round when you look at the other players on the board and what they can do for you at other positions. So I think a decent amount of teams still value running back. And that means, I mean, what are we going to see, Matt? Like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, like not 8, 9, 10, I think probably in the first 2 days, which means guys are going to get work early in their career.
Yeah. And it's very likely. And it's funny because you look at it and you say, well, maybe one guy doesn't matter as much, but you look at Barkley, and I think it was a great decision on the Giants' part, just because you have, when you have a player who can outperform his surrounding talent, and you can give him the ball in innumerable ways, you start with him as a building block. I think that's a smart thing to do because you can add more linemen. You can get a quarterback later. It's harder to get a good quarterback than it is to get a good running back. And I think that that's the type of thing where but the quarterback needs more help, I think, than a great running back needs, you know, and there aren't many great running backs. And I think Saquon Barkley, it has that type of potential. And you look and you say, well, New England ran the ball for the past few years. They run the ball as much, you know, as anybody in the league, you know. So it's a – and we had a Super Bowl that looked like the 1970s, you know, this past week. So, you know, in terms of going back to the future, you know, we've had some – quite a bit of slot receivers coming up in the draft, you know, in the past few years. And I think this year really is the revenge of the big men when it comes to this class. There's a lot of – you know, 6'3", 6'4", 220-pound guys like, you know, Miles Boykin and J.J. Arcega-Whiteside. And, you know, even the smaller guys, quote-unquote, you could even say Deebo Samuel by comparison at 215 or 210, 215 pounds is small for this list. But then you've got Hakeem Butler and Kelvin Harmon. And you look at even Antoine Wesley at 6'6", 200, probably will add a little bit of, you know, pounds to his frame. A.J. Brown, D.K. Metcalf, Jalen Hurd, N'Keal Harry. I mean, these are guys all at least 215 pounds, and they're all names that I think we should become familiar with at the top end of this class.
Yeah, it's interesting to play these two narratives off against each other. You know, last year, the big receivers, with the exception of maybe Cortland Sutton, it was a bloodbath, and we've seen them. Well, the verdict's still out. Green Bay, in a very interesting alignment, took three of the big receivers last year on the third day, and Valdez-Scantling flashed here and there. St. Brown flashed here and there. Jamon Moore, the first one drafted, didn't do as much. But otherwise, these guys, you know, Aitman ended up on the field a little bit at the end of the year for Oakland. With Tate in Cincinnati, that was weird mixed signals. You know, we did end up on the team, and Marvin Lewis being gone could give him a new lease on life. Alan Lazard, not sure what's going to happen with him. It wasn't pretty. But this class, we'll see. Then it comes back to, like, it revolves around Green Bay. Who are going to be the teams that take these guys? Who are going to be the teams that, with the quarterbacks or the offenses, that they feel like this is a guy that can harvest more value from an outside a wide receiver role than you know, receivers with different strengths, which comes back to the Barkley thing. When you're talking about the Barkley thing, Matt, I do want to say this first and foremost, okay? It still comes down to the plan. What's the plan?
Yep.
You took Barkley number two. What kind of Mike Shula, what kind of offense, Pat Shurmur, are you building to maximize that value, to magnify? It's not just rational coaching, you know, it's inspired coaching. You have this singular thing on offense. Now you put it, set up your offense in a way so that it's at these critical points and just blasts up the, you know, magnifies the value of tactical advantages you create with play designs and execution and good play, good coaching, good personnel. And that's where the player's influence on the win and loss comes in. And yeah, the Patriots going back to the future, but the Patriots running game doesn't need a Saquon Barkley to unlock the value, and their offense might not create as much, you know, harvest as much of the Barkley value as an offense when you take him number two. That's such a huge outlay of capital. It's all for naught if you don't have a plan and an effective plan to make him the difference in games.
And I think there's a dissonance though between analysts and coaches in this regard, because I've been having a chance to read some of Bill Walsh's The Winning Edge, which mm-hmm. is pretty much the Bible for coaches. I mean, if you look at, you know, any coach in the league, they will tell you that you have to read that book before you become a head coach. I mean, it's just, that's, you know, it outlays so many different things about how they work in the NFL and what's recommended from, you know, perhaps one of the, you know, 4 to 5 greatest coaches in history. Mm-hmm. And you look at that, and one of the things that's talked about is how coaches and football teams look at rookies, no matter how high they're picked. And sometimes what it is they realize that rookies have to make that adjustment to the league socially, in terms of their off field, in terms of their work habits, in terms of, you know, being able to build up and have some level of stamina, assignments, being assignment sound, being, you know, understanding basically the playbooks and all of these different things, that there's a lot of points where coaches, even with high round picks, are reticent to put too much on their plate in a way where it can be, they almost look at the first year as like, we're not really expecting, we may expect high things from a player in terms of certain types of production. But I kind of look at it and think that we expect first year the player to get plugged in. And if they're Saquon Barkley, who has the size, who's like a bigger Marshall Faulk. Like, I mean, you could say he's in abilities, he might be a bigger, faster Marshall Faulk. And if that's the case, you'd expect, well, how are we going to put him in an offense where he can express those Marshall Faulk-like qualities right away? And I think that the dissonance there is that with coaches, I think they're kind of like, you got to earn it, or let's just see if you can do it, right, some of the basic things, and then we can add on to it, because you're not a year one project. Because if we put all this on your plate and you fail, then, you know, then we're not getting as much out of it as we could. And let's also just look at the team around us and say, hey, look, you know, we didn't even know. I mean, their offensive line got better, but it was only after they added some players and some of these guys started to figure out what they needed to do. Like Nick Solder had to kind of figure out a new blocking scheme. Jamon Brown got added into the mix later. They didn't know which center they were going to, you know, they had Jalapio, I think. And then you have Pulley, who helped out for a little bit. And this was all still kind of in flux. So I kind of look at it and think that as analysts, sometimes it's easy for an analyst to pull up game book numbers and just, you know, spout out game book numbers and then try and be prescriptive and predictive to coaches without really understanding the game on that level. And I think people eat that up, and there's some validity to that on a certain level. But at the same time, I don't think that it's kind of like letting your financial analyst manage your operations. You know, they're going to look at the spreadsheet and start talking about all the numbers, but they have no people skills whatsoever, no understanding of leadership, no understanding of process. And then they're going to sit there and tell you what needs to be done, when really what it is they're offering good insight, but they don't have the perspective and training necessary to really get it. And I think it's just easy but at the same time, they might be the most popular person in the water cooler, you know, near the water cooler in the break room, because they're noting something that's actionable, and then they can complain about it and all the workers can complain. But when you have, you know, but when you actually have someone who has an understanding of how the operation works, and you can actually lead well, then, you know, someone who just nitpicks and points out some of these issues, it ends up, you know, it ends up being something where it's like, okay, how do we convert this from just being complaining to actual worthwhile insight? And I think that that's where the dissonance is with our analysis outside of teams and what's actually going on in terms of the context sure. within it.
There's definitely in this and hey, the NFL is willing to remind us frequently, like, you don't know, you know. it's almost like, Matt, it's almost like when a coach says that, that's when somebody's actually hit on a real criticism that they need to face, and in that moment they're not facing it. You know, right. they'd rather say, you just don't understand my job well enough to know to criticize my decision.
Right.
And there's a lot more than went into that. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. Or they're frustrated and they don't want to give away what it is that sure. they do need to tell, because
– which is silly, by the way. I mean, hopefully sometime in the future, like 13 years from now when we do a show together, another, you know, 26 years doing shows together, that we can say, now this like ridiculous cloak and dagger, you know, intelligence counter, like the way the NFL acts, like what happens behind. And I know, because there's so much money on the line, it seems like it, but the money doesn't really hinge on the actual outcome of the games.
Yeah.
You know, the actual outcome of the game is just the script or plot that week. The show is still going to bring in all the money.
And I agree that there's an element of that for sure. But I would also even just add is, you know, look at somebody like Bill Parcells. And, you know, I was sure. having, you know, Eric Stone and I have been going back and forth a lot over the past few weeks, and he's been obsessed about Bill Parcells coaching lately. and so, you know, he was sharing with me an interview, a press conference interview with Parcells. And one of the things he commented on, which I thought was very astute, was how Parcells basically didn't want to throw anybody under the bus, basically mm-hmm. answered questions the same way, was very prepared. And what he really was doing was trying to explain, trying not to give up any information to reporters, and also to control the flow of information and control uh-huh. how things went with the game. And part of that, too, was about leadership with your team and making sure that if you give up too much, it can create issues with your personnel and how they perceive what's going on and how you view them. And they end up watching that or hearing about that. And so I think coaches have a fine line where they do have to be careful about what they share and give up. But there is an extent where it can get ridiculous. I agree.
And I get it. And it's really effective. And Parcells and Belichick are in lockstep in this way of really projecting almost like a grump, you know, and basically like circling the wagons and saying like, I'm not really going to give you what you're looking for. Like, yeah. I'm going to play this theater out with you for the media, because that's what we have to do. But I'm not actually here to reveal anything. And you're right that all that sends a signal to the players. It's like, this is our family. We settle things inside of our family. There's Antonio Brown narratives here right now about right. this. You know? First and foremost, you're loyal to the family. And like, it's one thing if a coach, like, you know, PJ Carlissimo or something, like if a coach chokes a player in practice or something like that, that's one thing. And certainly that's something that it should not be condoned, and it's assault and it's a crime. But the idea of like, if a coach goes over the line in a way that's maybe not illegal, like how many things that we never hear about in the public are settled behind the scenes every year? You know, yeah. fights, like actual fights that happen between players and team, but it's in the house, it's in our house, it's in our family. You never go to somebody outside of the family when we have problems. We settle our problems inside the family, and it's accountability and it's a culture. And I think Belichick and Parcells do a tremendous job projecting that culture, like through their public presence. But going, circling all the way back to what we originally went off on a tangent here, the idea of like Saquon Barkley and how to use him, or if you take a player that high, your offense or defensive scheme should be geared to unlock what it was that made you covet them so much, is that we can, because one thing that I think is not an excuse for coaches anymore is fear of failure. And I say that as somebody who's been crippled by fear of failure my whole life. Okay. Easier said than done. But the idea that, well, if we ask the rookie to do this, and I understand they're privy to everything that's gone on in practice and everything like that, if we ask the rookie to do this, and obviously you're not going to ask someone to do something that you have affirmative evidence they can't do. But as far as that, like putting more on the player's plate or trying something that to see if they can handle it and it fails, well, that's all self-correcting. I mean, we see teams fail every week. I mean, like the Patriots, 3 weeks out of this year, were one of the two or three worst teams that week. Against the Lions, against the Jags, against the Titans. They were terrible. They were failing all over the place. And that's you know, that's valuable sometimes to use the season as a laboratory. It's always a laboratory. Football's always a laboratory. And if you fail, so you fail, but you're pushing your team to the limits. You're finding out what the limits are of what they can do. Like, that's the thing about Belichick and all the versatility and changing things on the fly that has been the narrative about the Super Bowl. It's this idea of trusting your players to do things that you may find out in the moment that they can do or not. In the Super Bowl, even, you know, where the fear of failure goes back to, like, we're going to do what we know we do well. And if that doesn't work, well, we'll see what we can figure out. And Belichick anticipates that and bakes that into what his plan is. Yeah. And he's simulating what the other coach is going to do.
But he also knows. He also knows a lot more football than most coaches.
Well, I love that article of him being in the basement of the Hall of Fame as a kid for hours reading football books. Like, that's perfect. If you were to try to, like, poetically or as in the novel of Bill Belichick's life, like the thing that John Boyce did, that simulation, which was fantastic, and like say what was Belichick doing when he was 12 years old? Like, all the other kids are out at beach or amusement park or whatever.
It's kind of like this, Bloom. I mean, there are, whether it's music or whether it's writing, you know, there are writers who are famous for mystery novels. There are some that are famous for bodice ripper, you know, romance novels. Some do true crime. You know, some are horror writers. Now maybe some of that is that they're locked in by, you know, by the industry to write these types of books when they could do more. And maybe that's part of it, but some of it also can be that that's all they can write. Just like musicians where, you know, you might look at Kendrick Lamar and say he's a great rapper and he's a great hip hop artist. Now, maybe he can sing the hell out of country music. Maybe he can play classical piano. Maybe he can sing opera. I don't know, but there are certainly some musicians that you look at and you go, you wouldn't hire them to be a studio musician to play on a variety of different albums because they wouldn't be seamless in it. They don't understand the genre. They don't understand how all that works and how it applies to make it sound good. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have some musicians who basically make a living playing on Kendrick Lamar albums, D'Angelo albums, on, you know, on country music albums, on classical albums, in, you know, jazz albums. They can do it all. And but there's very few of those. And I kind of think that when, you know, one of the things that, again, just bringing up what Eric and I had talked about recently is that really, when you look at coaches, we expect coaches just to say, well, okay, well, they were hired to do that. They were hired because they knew how to do X, but we should expect them to know how to do A through M. And because of the fact that the verbiage is so different, and things are taught so differently, just on a play to play adjustment level with certain types of run fits, maybe, or how to defend a run, that may be too outsized of an attack task. You know, Ray Ratto basically asking the question in his Deadspin article about, well, you know, Bill Belichick just adjusted and did this. Why don't more coaches do that? And it's kind of like, well, Ray, the same reason as great of a columnist that you are, that you're not writing bodice ripper romances, you know, and making tons of money creating the new Fabio, you know, on the cover of whatever you're doing, and that you're not transitioning out of sports writing to, you know, doing business analysis. It's the same reason, is that, you know, because you can't, most likely, you know, and that's no knock on Ray Ratto, who's a fantastic columnist, but it's that's the truth. It's like, you're not going to ask, you know, you're not going to ask a lot of these coaches to do that, even though we look at the greats and go, well, Bill Walsh ran, you know, created this system, this offensive system. And during a strike game, he ran the wishbone against Bill Parcells and ran it well. Well, that's great. Again, we're talking about one of those versatile musicians as opposed to most musicians. And I think that, you know, you ask, you know, you probably ask, you know, the Falcons head coach to change his system and do different things, and you're barking up the wrong tree.
Right. Okay. And this, you're right. I mean, Belichick is singular without a doubt. But that being said, we can take this conversation, Matt, and we could apply it to Sean McVay as the hot archetype in head coaches right now too. And there's this idea of, what is perceived, and this gets into narrative, this is all laden with narrative, because the idea that what is so there's the gap between what's perceived or posited as the source of the success of a coach and what actually is in reality where the success comes from. And there's overlap, but obviously there's slippage between those two things. And I think that, like I said, the picture of Belichick as a teenager or a kid in the basement of the Hall of Fame reading books for hours in the summer, it's just perfect. It's too on the nose. And it's the idea, we've talked about this with other people in the industry before, Matt, the idea is like, it's like, well, since you haven't done the work, you can never understand, you know, you have to have been immersed in this for 30 years to understand what I'm talking about. Goes back to that idea of it's, you know, it's impenetrable. And that's just Belichick, because of how much he's done, how much he's read, how much, well, all the people he's learned from. And that's just a singular thing.
None of that mattered when he was in Cleveland and he had an owner who ran off Paul Brown and ran off Jim Brown and made bad decisions everywhere. And the best thing that he was for was basically to have a house where people could basically urinate and defecate on in the yard, apparently, as a normal practice, because he basically, that was the best thing that he was available for. Sorry to just bring my own personal thoughts into that. But really, I mean, that's what's interesting, because he was lauded as a football genius and this young, great thing. But the interesting thing about maybe not narrative in general, but some narratives is that we pick out the thing that's the most interesting about the player, like, with the coach, because you look at McVay and it's like, oh, he remembers every play. Well, it's kind of like talking about a musician who has perfect pitch. Doesn't mean that they still write good music just because they have perfect pitch.
Sure.
It's a parlor trick at this point. Right. It may help. It may just be a parlor trick. It just depends on how it's applied.
Absolutely. And so it applies to McVay or Belichick, right? Because Belichick is so singular, and the confluence of all these forces that only meet at Belichick, okay? But the reality is, and the Pepper Johnson article was great. I know you, I was included in Eric's thing. I'll keep coming back to that a lot, because that was a rare peek behind the curtain. And I hope it doesn't mean Pepper Johnson doesn't get hired ever again, but it might mean that. It really might.
Sadly.
But this idea that Belichick actually listens to his assistants. That doesn't mean that he's going to do what you say, or he's deferential, like Pepper Johnson said. So sometimes he's just going to say no, and that's just – but you know that he really grappled with it and considered it and cares what you say and puts stock in what you say. And that is something I think that doesn't have to be unique to Belichick. And that's something where if Atlanta coach or whatever coach, they can't be Belichick. But if he harnesses and summons up the collective brain power and experience and acumen and wisdom of his staff – you can kind of approximate a Belichick. And part of what makes Belichick, I think too, is like his curiosity, his willingness to change, which is something more associated with youth than old age. But he's open to everything. You've seen him morph and reinvent himself and morph and reinvent himself. And that's not something that has to be so singular to him. That's something that it should be standard in the CEO type. We were talking about this stuff with someone on Twitter, Matt, and saying that what's frustrating is that in a real meritocracy, CEO types should be known for these things. Like all CEOs, if the most qualified people were becoming the CEOs, they'd all have these qualities, and they wouldn't. Because someone's like, is it really just that a lot of NFL coaches aren't good, and that's why we're so laudatory of Belichick? You know, just that every leader of some billion or $100 million organization should have these qualities, but they're singular because of the NFL culture, not necessarily selecting for them.
I would agree. I think that's exactly what that is. And because you think about how coaches are hired, and it's not what this great coach is doing over at Slippery Rock. You know, it's what Colin Cowherd thinks about that coach.
And it actually influences her. This is where narrative is terrible in some ways, because the owners are actually influenced by this stuff, and it does actually filter down to the real thing, and even actually sets the culture. Not even moves the needle. It is the needle.
Yeah. By the way, you know what Bill Belichick is? He's the Miles Davis of his coaching, because he is.
I've said that many times. He'll steal from anybody.
Yes.
You know?
And he does listen to his assistants, and he does play to their strengths, and he is constantly changing. And
yeah, and they really divide up the work there so that I think everybody has a lot of say. Like, I know that I saw that Ben Volen article was like Chad O'Shea, who's now the offensive coordinator in Miami. You know, he was like, I believe, like the red zone coordinator. And I think the offensive line coach was in charge of like blitz protections or something like that. The point is, like, everybody had a lot on their plate, but they were like, they ran their own shop and they were they could feel that way. Now, something not as as like flowery as being curious or trusting your subordinates is that Belichick's the GM too. I mean, Belichick gets to buy the groceries and cook, and that might be something that's just only Belichick, but he can get the perfect players, or he just has it. He might not even be able to express exactly what he's looking for in a player, but he I'm sure over the years, that's why Kyle Van Noy can become Kyle Van Noy for New England when he stalls out for Detroit and how many other times. And there was a real interesting from Jason over the cap, Jason, that the Rams had the most players like above 11 million or something like that. And the Patriots had the most players between like 1.5 and 5.5 million. And Belichick could say, like, I know what job you can do your job.
Yeah.
And I can make a kind of style of football where you doing your job is going to help us win.
So here's a question. Does it require a lot of knowledge of the game or of your subject matter, like a serious breadth and depth of knowledge to be open to listening and trusting others and putting them in positions because you need to recognize whether or not they have it or not, whether they truly have the goods or not? Does it take Belichick's type of singular knowledge to do that? Or would you argue that it doesn't take that?
Well, if we're going to be super simplistic about it, what it really takes is just an acknowledgement of the limits of your own knowledge, like to trust other people. You know, it's like, I might not know everything, or I might not have, I mean, just on a basic personality level, which again, CEO types don't generally always have that quality. Hopefully, like the good ones do. It should be selected for. It's not always selected for. But I mean, I certainly don't think that somebody who hasn't been very close to the game for a long time could be an NFL head coach. You know, I think it would be laughable. I mean, it would be a joke. But I think that advisors to those types that they trust can be people who, because, you know, Matt, one of the things talking about narrative again in the draft, right? I mean, or talking about football in general, or the right to talk about football, or to take your opinion seriously if you talk about football, like if you've never played the game.
Right.
Like, well, you never played the game. You don't understand. But I do think, and this is where spreadsheet analytics cue Dave Gettleman, like mocking people, all of us on our computers, right, is off base, because it isn't necessarily letting the analytics make the call when you're on the clock, but it's looking at things the way they do that may allow you to see things that you wouldn't see otherwise.
Yes.
And being open to the idea, again, the limits of your own knowledge. And so I think that's the crucial thing. I mean, Belichick's are made, not born, in the sense of all that he is devoted into it. But all of these people let their lives become consumed by football. It's how they let it become consumed by football, or what it was about, or what like the outboard motor engine was like guiding, like pushing them, and how they were steering it that determined, like, with the hours that every single one of these guys that are head coach have put into football in their life, they all could be Belichick's, or maybe not Belichick's, but the Belichick version of themselves, but they're just not doing it.
And we certainly have seen our share of coaches who've shown some versatility. I mean, I think we all think of Marty Schottenheimer as a, you know, run the ball prehistoric type of coach in terms of his offenses. But when he did have a quarterback, he let the quarterback throw it and be aggressive downfield. I think that when you look at Chuck Knoll and all those years that it was like tie up Terry Bradshaw and just run the ball, you saw them unleash Bradshaw eventually with that type of offense they did. Mike Shanahan with the Terrell Davis years. But then at the same time, being able to willing to do some different work with Robert Griffin, to also, you know, open up that offense a little bit more with Rod Smith and McCaffrey. I mean, there are situations where you can see coaches go against their type and look at what personnel they have and be able to do more with it, or whatever the game dictated. So it's definitely there.
It's gonna become, I think, more, well, the whole idea of moving towards younger head coaches, et cetera. But again, it doesn't necessarily have to be younger coaches. So it's gonna be interesting. I'm gonna grab the wheel And so I'm going to touch on a few other narrative things before. And I mean, we've been, I'm good and comfortable. You know, I'm cozied up to the bar and good. I don't even know what beer I'm on in our conversation, drinking back this conversation with you. So but I just want to go back to narrative because there were a couple other overarching narrative and draft things that I had down that I just wanted to toss out there. So when I first thought about this, when you threw me draft and narrative, I thought about the narratives among all of us about the draft, players in the draft, teams in the draft, whatever, just that thing, that never ending conversation that we are all having about this and adding to with our work and through social media. But then the part that where it gets real fascinating, Matt, to when I started thinking about it was, and we alluded to this in many times in our conversation already, is that players have their own narratives about themselves, about the draft, about teams. Maybe we're only privy to a little bit of it, but they have narratives. Front office, and this gets into like you said, we were talking about, you were alluding to, well, is it important that someone really knows football? Because maybe, you know, Sashi Brown or whoever, like a front office person doesn't know football in the same way that a coach does. And you get into all kinds of issues with that. But front office people are going to have their own narratives about the draft. The coaches are going to have their own narratives about the draft. And one that I think is really underrated when it comes down to narratives that the secret puppet masters of the narratives we end up talking about are the agents. I think a lot of stuff that we end up hung up on or that shapes conversations that we have may originate with agents. We're getting better at picking it out for sure. And this is where we go off into, you know, la la land, Matt, the idea of narrative. Okay. Is there a real narrative that we can, if we pick the right perch or look at it the right way, we can discern from things that have happened in this player's career, life, all the components, things that they say. Sometimes there's a little glimmer when you're like reading an interview with them or watching them that you can just say like, oh, this first three chapters of this story is going to create this arc that some of it's based on players we've seen before that are similar in key ways. And some of it's just a feel you get for a player. Are each one of these players, and they're making a movie of Andrew Hawkins' life, by the way, I saw, you know, is each one of these players embarked on something that later on we can look back on and it will make sense in that narrative way? Or is that just our brains trying to organize this thing in a way so we feel better at night that it does make sense to us, but that's just something that we impose on it and it's not real?
Now let's take Kyler Murray for an example. You know, I've seen this week that
his dad, see, that one's real interesting because you get his family involved.
Right.
Now we're getting bigger and bigger.
Right. Because you get the whole, he's being interviewed and he's looking to his dad and his dad, a stage father, and
his dad's history. Yeah.
Yeah. And
the same thing is playing out again.
Yeah. You know, so is this a situation where, you know, people are unfairly judging Kyler Murray because he's not smoothly answering a question on national TV about whether he's going to play baseball or football, right? But he has to be up there to say it. And maybe he should have said something differently. Make him a good leader? Does that make him
right?
You know,
oh God, I saw so much of that. Yeah. I was, of course, pushing back against that. Maybe it's right. But what I think we have to address here, Matt, is that you better bet that people who have their finger on the button in the NFL are also having that conversation or that kind of conversation and are influenced by events on that level, on that seemingly surface superficial level. And that's what's fascinating is these kinds of narratives. I mean, you see people just throw stuff out like, yeah, he's going to be just like his dad. I think whatever there was, I don't know all the specifics well enough to really speak on it, but I know that there's often allusions to this connection between like his dad being between two sports and now here he is. And it really could be not only like apple doesn't fall far from the tree or something like that, but his dad is influencing it.
Yeah.
He's looking to his dad. And that means that the outcome of Kyler Murray's story, whatever it's going to be, his dad has the pen in his hand in a way. And teams are absolutely not just thinking about, is he going to change his mind to baseball or is he committed to football or things like that, but even things. And I think actually some decision makers in the NFL are drawn to it, like it's a catnip for them. These like single, simple stories that just sum up a player and allow you to just draw a black line through them or draw the red circle around
it
them.
Works for fans. Yeah. Fans love eat that up like catnip too, you know? Yeah, so, I mean, it's the same thing. Like Sean McVay remembers every play. Well, that's great. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he remembers all his mistakes as well as all of his successes.
Right. And for owners, it's like he comes and watches the game with me every Monday and explains the game. I trust him.
Right.
You know, and that's why he's the GM.
And just because you remember something doesn't mean you know how to use it. You know,
right. Well, since you're bringing up the McVay thing, and this, I'll take the Belichick parallel to him, that, you know, a lot of people are pointing out that it's that he, again, the limits of his own knowledge. He trusts. I mean, Wade Phillips is basically the head coach of the defense. Right. And by the way, Wade Phillips is a Super Bowl champion in my eyes.
Right.
Has he ever been on a Super Bowl champion? I think he was on the Broncos Super Bowl champion teams, right?
Right. I think so.
I hope he's won a Super Bowl ring, because that dude, he belongs in the Hall of Fame. He's one of the best things about football, Wade Phillips, and everything that he embodies. And speaking of narrative, like his dad and how that echoes that.
Sure. Well, everything was born in the AFC Central.
Yes. Earl Campbell.
The West Coast offense.
Love you, Blue. Oh, man. Yes. Now, this is if we get to meat and potatoes time now. So McVay, he knows the limits of his own knowledge. He trusts his football guy. He's got a football guy, Wade Phillips, that he trusts to run his defense. He has the respect of his team, and not because he's their age or something like that, but because he really treats everybody like a true human being and acknowledges their humanity and makes that human connection with everybody, like actually cares. I used to joke that, you know, you can, I'm not sure, I'm going to keep it PG, but really joked about writing a New York Times nonfiction like book for business MBA types just called Give a Shit. You can leave that out if you want.
Right. Sorry. That's okay.
But it's actually caring. It's actually caring. Like, he actually cares.
Yeah.
And that's the secret sauce, right? He has the respect of the people that work with him. And he's again, in a similar story, he's very deferential to them. He understands the limits of his knowledge. He is genuinely passionate about the team and the people in the building. And that's the secret sauce. Not that he's 33 and can like see through the numbers like some mathematician or something.
Right. Right. Because he actually knows how to manage and lead, you know, and he does, because you wouldn't get to the Super Bowl. You wouldn't turn around your team and have two successful years the way that you did. And you just happen to run up against a grandmaster. I mean, that's just how it is. It's one of those things where, you know, sometimes you just have to accept the fact that you got beat, you know, and that doesn't make you bad all of a sudden, you know, it doesn't make your players bad all of a sudden. It just, your limitations were exposed, and now it's time to move forward and see how you can shore up some of those limitations. But yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I'm with you on that for sure.
So, you know, we're getting to, it's fun because I know we could have easily had a show here, but we just talked more about stoking the fires. We got plenty of time for that, to stoke the fires about these individual players and these individual questions. And there's so much, it's fascinating. The quarterback thing is going to drive everything. Who's going to take the bait? When do they do it? I don't think Gruden's going to do it, but I would love to see Gruden like talk somewhat, like dangle out there for a while, as it seems like they might be doing. Oh, well, Carr, we're not really sold, so that somebody trades up to number four. That would be beautiful to take advantage of that. All this edge class is really great. They're very different from each other, so it's going to be interesting to see how that sorts itself out on draft night. Who takes who? It's interior defensive line, offensive line, great line, inside linebacker class, which heartens me as a Steelers fan. Can one of them just fall to 20? and so much. And then, you know, always we get the next chapter, or the first chapter in some ways, in these teams' history. And the Dolphins are really fascinating because this tanking thing is out there. I don't remember, Matt, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't ever remember us getting a narrative coming up like tanking, coming to this team this year. They are going to tank. Like, they have already decided to do it. And in reality, I might talk about this when Cecil and I recorded yesterday. I mean, in a dynasty league, right? If you didn't have a rule against tanking, sometimes tanking is like the best strategy.
Right.
Like, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it actually gives you the best chance of doing what you want to do. And they certainly have a fresh start with Flores, and Flores can be the next Belichick in the sense that it sounds like he's been cross-trained and everything, scouting everything, and really understands the system, and not just one part. That's, I mean, there's so many
we'll
things.
And we'll see if he has the people skills and to do what Belichick that you describe Belichick does,
right.
You know, right. And if he does, then it's going to be great. It'll be great to see. If not, then, you know, add him to the list, but it's going to be, right. This is that time. You're right. To see whether that's going to be the case or not. And I'm glad you brought up the Raiders, because, you know, Gruden is going to, be a stimulating topic of conversation.
Oh yeah. Well, this is it, right? I mean, you traded Amari Cooper and Khalil Mack for this. So we're listening, you know, we're waiting like, in Caddyshack, we're waiting, you know?
Yeah. And the same is going to be true of, you know, can the Bears build up enough around Trubisky with Nagy? Mm-hmm. What's Freddie Kitchens and the Browns going to do collaboratively? Mm-hmm. You know, what are they going to figure out there? I mean, because Kitchens certainly, as we've talked about Belichick, well, Kitchens seems to be that guy who, I've never been more excited about the Browns since they've mm-hmm. returned to Cleveland because of Kitchens. I mean, listen to that interview, talk about narratives. What I heard was a guy like Parcells, like Belichick, who understands the strengths of the people around them, tries to figure out what that is, and trusts them to do it. And I think that if he has the right perspective or mindset from his owner and GM, this could be a really nice turnaround for Cleveland finally. And you know, because of the fact that just listening to him in that interview in the press conference, he sounded like an accomplished leader and manager of an operation, as opposed to somebody who just got hired because they had a specialty and that specialty was successful under a great leader, but they didn't have the leadership themselves. So, you know, this year we're going to get a chance to see that also with Cleveland. What do they add to this team that has shown the level of talent it has and played in a lot of close games, and nearly made the playoffs? You know,
Go ahead. Yeah. So this is fun when we think about draft narratives. And I think you're everything you're saying, I would echo, you know, dare I say, it's more fun to be a Browns fan than a Steelers fan right now. You know,
well, it might be more fun to be a Browns fan than a Steelers fan because of what's going on with the Steelers, in addition to what's happening with the Browns.
Speaking of narrative and things like that, and things creeping in and out of our organization. But with Cleveland, going back to Cleveland, with Mayfield, we can go back to last year, mm-hmm. right? And Cleveland, speaking of narrative, has been a team that, whether it actually was true or not, that you'd hear about, Sam Darnold's going to go back to school if Cleveland takes him. You know, remember that?
Right.
I mean, and so on, like this idea that Cleveland's where players go to die. And generally, it's not that unfounded that say that the players' career trajectories, if they had gone somewhere else than Cleveland, there's coach killers, players that are coach killers, and there's teams that are player killers, and they were a player killer. And Mayfield, which matched what the narrative about his energy, his character, his whole vibe anyway, was like, oh man, that just makes me more fired up. Like, I'm going to be the one that ends it, you know? And I believe he like really, because everything he projects, he is not afraid to project, which is now, Matt, where we're getting to the part that I think you and I can really geek out on. It's like trying to psychoanalyze players and then adding that as like the thing that like informs your context for what you observe on the field and how you expect them to make that bridge, that great divide. The number one, Matt, when I teach my NFL draft class in college, we make NFL draft studies, an actual academic department. Hey, the rate things are changing. It can happen in our lifetimes. It can happen in our lifetimes. Dan Hatman, it's going to be actually a university, like accredited university, where you get like actual bachelor's degrees and master's degrees, and we'll be professors there. Let's make it happen, Dan, if you're listening. The first thing we're going to read on the syllabus is your Great Divide article. First thing. Absolutely. And everybody's going, and we're going to focus on that, because the psychoanalysis part is the part that can inform us. And we were psychoanalyzing Baker Mayfield and being like, this is a brash, like, banty rooster, you know? And sure enough, he's doing it.
Yeah, he is. You know,
he's changing the story, and they're psyched. And the simplest, sometimes it's the beauty of the, in the simplicity. The simplest thing here was there's a good feeling around this team. They didn't come through for the Steelers and beat the Ravens, thanks. But they almost did. They certainly put up a great fight in that last game. I mean, they were right there, and the Ravens are going to give CJ Mosley the franchise tag or whatever. I have to watch it. It's not a good time to be a Steelers fan. Anyway, and he's doing it. So why would you mess with that? Why would you mess with it? You hear Todd Monken and what he's saying. That's fantastic. Yeah. It's a fantastic mindset. Again, like what John Kitna was saying about, you know, go out there and take the shot. Like, don't worry about if it fails. I've got your back, you know. Teams got each other's back. They're ready to go out there. Football's fun for them again. And it's exciting, and it fits something we talked about. You know, that Baker Mayfield, not only because he's Baker Mayfield, the well, it's Cleveland factor, could actually be a positive.
Yeah, and it does. And then what we're seeing is that it does oftentimes – come down to the personalities. It comes down to the personalities of the people who are involved, you know, and
right.
And so it, the, you know, and it does have to do with power points of those positions, you know, and some, and you also need a combination of players whose personalities work well together, right. You know, because right. We saw, you know, in Pittsburgh, I won't go into, you know, I'll preserve you from too much of the pain with that. But, you know, we know with that. And but at the same time, you look at a guy like, you know, Baker Mayfield and Nick Chubb. They couldn't be more opposite. They were roommates in training camp. But Nick Chubb is the kind of the very stoic, quiet, just unassuming person who, you know, people didn't even recognize, you know, during the, you know, I mean, during, I think, you know, the HBO show that they had this past year, Hard Knocks. And, you know, you just seem like an anonymous figure. But you need this certain kind of dynamic of players who are soldiers who carry out on a certain level and some who are the leaders, you know, in terms of being vocal and the type of personality that they project on the field. And so you got to have a blend of that. And, you know, people lead in different ways. And I think that's the thing that's interesting about narrative to me is that, you know, we often look for one thing, or that because we see that one thing in one person, we don't like it in the other. And, you know, Bill Belichick would get, you know, he wasn't as into, he didn't come across in the way that Bill Parcells did, or Bill Cowher, or, you know, Bill Walsh. I guess he needed to be a Bill to be a coach. Yeah. Bill Belichick, you know.
King William.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's one of those things that we oftentimes, when it comes to narrative, will pick out certain things and then try and apply it to a different person and not realize that right. Each person has some, you know, there's different traits and they don't all have to be the same thing.
It's a different story, but it's a different story for everybody. But I think there is a story there.
Yeah.
And all we can do to try to make sense of it from the outside, peeking through keyholes, like I like to say, is use the range, you know, trying to be humble about it, but fit into things that we know from the past. So it seems like the balance is still good in so much that we are producing a lot more content, I think, that is at a high level of discourse about the draft. I hope that the draft can continue to become something that, I mean, I feel like the kinds of conversations that we just had amongst ourselves is now something that more and more fans and more beat writers are taking. Even beat writers being so involved in the off season is something that I don't remember as much, say, 15 years ago. And it's fun because it's merging to the point where people from draft Twitter are going to be in NFL decision-making positions 5, 10, 15 years from now. You know, Eric Galco is heavily involved with XFL. And I think that's going to continue to be the trend where those walls get broken down. And again, I'm telling you, Matt, you're influencing the NFL. I guarantee it. I guarantee it. I guarantee somewhere things that you're writing and people that write on your site too are filtering back up and triggering, you know, thought processes. And it's fun to be part of that process. And I think as long as we can keep it fun It's great. I think DAF Twitter is a lot more civil than it used to be. What do you think?
I'm still waiting, but I think you're probably right. I mean, it's matured some, and I think it will continue to mature a little bit more until we have the next cycle of new upstarts who have a lot of energy and a lot of new ideas and great ideas. But they don't have the maturity quite yet. Personality wise, emotionally, or just understanding the medium, and that'll start over again and we'll be cyclic. But I think that, yeah. But I agree. I think we're entering a mature cycle of that where people are kind of looking around and going, hey, we're all in this together and we're all trying to figure out things. And just because I may think that that point is idiotic or I don't agree with that point doesn't mean that I have to treat that person like they're an idiot, you know?
No. And hey, as long as we can get like NFL prop bets on the combine and the draft and sports betting in all 50 states, then there'll be money flowing into draft writing for the first time ever.
Hey, there you go. So to end this, who are three players that you're because you're obviously getting ready to do the Bloom 100 for the first time this year. Who are three or four players that you're most looking forward to watching that you haven't yet?
Well, Kyler Murray has to jump out of the list right away, because if he does give football a go, he's getting drafted either as a first or second rounder. And even as a second rounder, I mean, it's actually second round is the perfect place to take Kyler Murray if you can. And I'm not sure what the ins and outs are of retaining the rights to a player, but I remember that the Cowboys held on to Drew Henson's rights for a while when he was in baseball and were able to trade him years later to the Texans and get a decent pick, I think, when they did. So if for a second round pick, you get 4 years of control of Kyler Murray, that's something to think about. Even if he says, I'm going to play baseball, even if he goes to training, to spring training in a week. The idea of have college offenses, these conversations, these narratives, Matt, that we've had over the years, like he plays in a college offense. And now it's like, well, Pat Mahomes plays basically in a college offense.
Yeah, now it's like, he plays in a college offense.
He plays in a college offense. So that means like quarterbacks that we thought only could succeed in college offense, send them to the CFL,
right,
can succeed in the NFL. And Kyler Murray, I think, is a great take on like asking that question. You mentioned the running backs. You I want to touch on some wide receivers. That's always my favorite position to watch. I think that's the position you get the most out of when you watch. It's easy. Like a lot of the things to get are like very readily apparent when you let these players watch over you. I think that Jalen Hurd is absolutely going to be an interesting guy. Mm-hmm. I like the guys. I like watching the players, Matt, that have the highest ceiling, or the players that evidence that. And this is where Matt Wet Blanket, usually right, Matt Waldman, comes in and says, when it's just in bits and pieces, then in the NFL, it's going to remain in bits and pieces, and the bits and pieces will get smaller and farther apart. It's the integrated technique that you want to look for. And even if it isn't sexy, that's what is going to stick. And that might be like a guy like Deebo Samuel. You know, I know that South Carolina, there was a lot more attention given to other receivers, but Samuel looks like he's going to translate right away.
Yeah.
So that's one. And then I think the tight end class is going to be really fun to watch, with the idea that, so the Patriots win the Super Bowl in the key drive, when Tony Romo, who's been a refreshing, fantastic addition to football media. Okay. And if you don't agree, you're not going to fight. I'm just saying, like, I feel like what Romo has added is certainly in the right direction, more in the direction of what if it became more standard from former players. With Jason Witten as kind of the other side of trying to be what everyone has always been when they're on TV. But when he was gushing about those three plays, it was a two tight end, two running back set. And something I think they had run, what was the number, like 11 times all year?
Right.
And they ran it on three straight plays, you know. Two tight ends. And I think you see in Philly that they would rather have three tight ends they can use. And in this age of versatile football, again, I think tight end is a position that makes the most positionless football makes sense as something to target. I know that was a keynote in Miami with Flores wanting players who can do more than one thing really well to build in that versatility, and tight end by the nature of the position builds that in. And this is going to be a great, great group to watch.
Well, I think I'm going to end this way and say, here are some players I'm looking forward to hearing what you think after you watch them, and I'm not going to say why.
Good. Let's have to follow up whether it's Couch or here. We have to come back to this and do like this is the cliffhanger, right. And then
so I'm interested in seeing you watch tight end H back Trevon Wesco of West Virginia, Hakeem Butler, the Iowa State wide receiver, DK Metcalf of Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. Then let's see who else is on here that I had mentioned. Antoine Wesley of Texas Tech. And then Jacques Patrick of Florida State. Devin Singletary of FAU. And then Will Greer at West Virginia. I'm just for different reasons, and I won't go into why so that I don't spoil anything.
Don't say anything to me about it all, because we'll do something where we talk about it in real time. But Metcalf, to put the cherry on the sundae, going all the way back to draft and narrative, Metcalf is going to be a highly polarizing player based on narrative, and there's the production argument versus the traits. And skills argument, tape versus numbers kind of stuff going on. Although he'll have the numbers that matter for athletic ability, I think. So that one is going to be one where it's going to be impossible to not, even if you don't intend to be part of a narrative, be part of a narrative for DK
Metcalf. Same with Riley Ridley. That's another one that seems to be popping up, but, listen, man, this was a fun show for us to just kind of open it up and just let it go. And so I hope everyone here, enjoyed as much as I did talking with the great Sigmund Bloom over at footballguys.com. You can check out his Bloom 100, which is just it's a draft tradition. You need to check it out. He does a few incarnations of the Bloom 100 throughout draft season. And if you're a fantasy writer, fantasy player, and you're not checking this out, then you're missing out in a big way. And even if you're a draft Nick who just enjoys learning about these players and getting a chance to learn about them from a very intelligent, creative perspective that Bloom offers, I would definitely recommend checking that out and everything that he does at Football Guys and on Twitter, of course, at Sigmund Bloom. So Bloom, always, it's a pleasure, brother.
Yeah. And I just want to say, always a pleasure. And I look forward to the day that when you are general manager of the Cleveland Browns and you have your cadre, your cabinet of people, and I'm still doing what I'm doing today because I'm happy where I'm at. And I'm in the war room on draft night because it's cool to be in the war room on draft night. And everyone says, how did that guy get in here? And you say, he's with me. And everyone says, okay.
Well, I guess one can dream, and you're dreaming for me. I'm pretty happy where I am too, but I'll say this. If that happens, they'll go, how did that guy get picked? And I'll go,
yeah, exactly.
100.
No, it's good.
I want to actually, what would be better is to have, Joe Buck or Troy Aikman go, yes, that was a Bloom 100 pick for the Cleveland Browns. Mm-hmm. That would be even better. Right. See, there's where we can
get
it
out there in the vernacular.
That's right. So thanks, everybody who've listened to this show. If you have feedback and you'd like to give me extensive feedback, you can always reach me at mountwaldmanrsp@gmail.com. Or you can just go to iTunes and you can rate and review, and you can do that there. Always appreciate the feedback that way. And of course, the RSP is under construction for April 1 download. We're at close to 190 players this year, which is more than I've ever done. And you get the pre-draft and post-draft, a login for both of those when you pre-order right now. 10% goes to Darkness to Light, just a fantastic organization designed to protect children from sexual abuse and train people in communities to be able to protect children, as well as how to further protect them if in case the unfortunate act does happen, so that it doesn't compound the actions there. So it's a terrific cause to get in front of and to be able to give 10% of each sale back to. I've been doing that since around 2012. And again, thank you everyone for all your feedback and your input into what goes on here at the RSP. Love you guys, and much love for you, Bloom. You guys have a good week.